And now, for the final question. You'll win the vacation package. You'll win the new house. You'll win the date with your favorite celebrity. You'll even win a new car!
Ooh! Ah!
The question is, who is Nestor Carbonell? My brother has a friend who can name almost any celebrity in any movie. It is ridiculous. His name is K-Dog. I feel like we all need a friend or acquaintance, at least, named K-Dog. And the SEAL team's nicknames happen to be part and parcel of the job. And there are some colorful ones. Same on Wall Street, seems to be a pretty nickname-heavy culture. Subsequent places I've worked, not so much. I've tried to bring them to some places with varying degrees of success. Anyway, K-Dog would probably know who Nestor Carbonell is. I fell in an IMDb black hole the other day, and if you have not discovered this feature, it is possible to go to an actor's name, and they allow you to just click on trailers once, or a trailer. It's not even named. It just says trailer, and it's unclear what it's actually for. It's as if it's a trailer for an actor named Nestor Carbonell, or pick your favorite celebrity. And it's like a personal trailer. I clicked on a guy named Jeff Fahey, and I sat and watched a whole bunch of trailers for movies that I kind of want to see, but if I had much less to do and with zero expectations, one or two of them look particularly bad. A bunch of them look like movies that you would see in the 1980s as a, let's call it, 9 or 10 year old boy. But I kind of like Jeff Fahey. If you don't know who he is, he played a character in Lost that had a fairly prominent role. He's been in a bunch of movies since. And if you look at his glamour shot by Deb on IMDb or anywhere else, that guy looks really cool. Cooler than most celebrities who are trying to look cool. I bet Jeff Fahey actually is cool. So Jeff Fahey played a character in the movie Lawnmower Man from, I believe it was 1992. And he plays a simpleton, a gardener who cuts grass for a living, as you might expect, the movie being titled Lawnmower Man. And through psychoactive drugs and other treatments from the esteemed and erudite Pierce Brosnan, he gains supernatural intelligence. Part of those treatments, by the way, involve this magical futuristic thing called virtual reality. I'm sure it sounded much more amazing back in 1992 when the movie was made, and presumably several years before that when Stephen King published the book by the same name. Here's a quote from the subsequent lawsuit by Stephen King against New Line Cinema. However suspicious about the studio's compliance, the author hired a team of private investigators to check out video store copies in 5 cities. King discovered New Line had released the video with his name still attached to it. Last month, New Line was found in contempt of court and will have to pay King $10,000 a day if his name is not removed by the end of this week. That's from Entertainment Weekly in 1994. I think it's amazing that Stephen King hired investigators in 5 cities. I mean, I don't know Stephen King, and by his cameos in movies, he seems like potentially a nice guy, but just given the subject matter expert and the fact that he looks like a guy where there might be a screw or two loose, I don't think I'd want to mess with Stephen King in any capacity. But when Lawnmower Man was released, they released it as Lawnmower Man by Stephen King, or Lawnmower Man, a Stephen King movie, or something like that. And the adaptation of the book was apparently so bad, or at a minimum, so far afield from Stephen King's version that he really didn't want his name attached to it. What is it about moving to suburbia that makes a man or a woman want to mow the lawn? I wonder what the origin of lawns is. I fell into a little bit of a Wikipedia black hole, and it started as rich people with large estates and presumably serfs who could tend the lawn. And actually, before serfs, goats or other grazing animals who could tend the lawn, little biological lawnmowers who propagate their machinery through time. And they had this because they could afford it, and also because it displayed their wealth to other people, displayed their wealth to the commoners or other wealthy people is probably who they were trying to impress. I think it's funny that it was started by wealthy people who could afford other people or animals to tend, and now most people who have lawns are not wealthy. Lots of them cut their own grass or spend very hard-earned money to pay people to tend it. Or maybe they just let it grow wild, and then it's probably worse than not having a lawn at all. They could probably just put some stones or pea gravel. I suppose there is something about molding the environment to one's use that probably explains a lot of the history of humanity. And by the way, I've been reading the book Sapiens, which is at the top of lots of bestseller lists over the last couple few years, I suppose, since it was published. And it is ridiculously good in many ways. Fairly, I don't use this word a lot, but fairly sweeping in its scope. But I suspect that that innate desire to mold the environment to one's use explains a lot of our progress as humans. I think we all like to build things. I think we all are born that way. We are innate creators. We are innate builders. Kids naturally express themselves in art, and somehow society, the education system, even parents, and maybe even other kids, just pull that out of us and make us something that is not in our innate nature. That being said, there were probably always people who were more creative and had a more expressive urge than others, more of an urge to build, invent a new tool, a new way to chip arrowheads. But I think a lot of that impulse really has been just sucked away from humanity, probably by the modern economic system and specialization of labor. I was in my car the other day, and my phone has a habit of committing suicide in my car as I'm moving. And luckily, it hasn't tried to murder me as it jumps off the cliff of my dashboard itself. I have a phone holder. It's the M-POW windshield holder that I got on Amazon a year or two ago for about $10. And that holder is the best that I found, but it isn't 100%. And every now and then, like I said, my phone will just take a nosedive off the pleather skyscraper in my car and end up any number of places, often under my seat. I had these gaps in the sides of my seat, like many of you probably do. Mine are just the right size for an iPhone to slip seamlessly through there as if friction and no other forces of physics exist except for its own momentum. And it gets lodged in the worst place under my seat. And so I was thinking to myself, I could just get some foam pads, like those foam pads that you kneel on in the gym when you're doing whatever, tricep or lat pull, something like that. And I could get something like that, probably just stuff it in on the sides of my seat. Granted, it might look kind of weird for anyone riding with me, but for the most part, it's just my kids. And so it would totally prevent the phone from being able to make its way there. Now, maybe I'll pat myself on the back for coming up with that idea, but it's pretty alarming that I hesitate to even do it. I don't know why. There's this sense that, you know what? In the modern economy, someone is designing that. I almost looked on Amazon to be like, phone stopper on the side of seats while driving or something like that. But you know what? I stopped myself. I can do this myself. I got this. Granted, it might not be the most aesthetically pleasing thing in the world, but it will do the job and it won't look half bad. It won't even take that much time to do this. Have we all become universal savants? Are we all universal servants as a result of our savantitude? The idea of a savant is that you're particularly good at one or a very small number of things, and that really is what most of us are, right? You become a plumber, you become a teacher, you become a tech product manager specializing in CAPTCHA. There are very few jack of all trades, and really, if you want to get paid, building on the concepts of career capital that have become popular lately, you need to focus, you need to develop your expertise. You need to be so good they can't ignore you in this one niche of the world so you can make money, all while you work for other people and don't get to branch out and have agency across a whole number of things. And this entails a whole bunch of risks for you and your career while it's good. Perhaps the analogy or metaphor from Warren Buffett about picking up pennies in front of a steamroller is a useful analogy. Given limited intelligence of our ancient ancestors and limited technology, tools, assets, information with which to build anything, I wonder if every cave dweller, every hunter-gatherer was just stuck with a feeling of ennui that she couldn't explain while sitting around the campfire, and that sense of anxiety or lostness stemmed from not being able to express herself or build in the way that we were meant to. So now, most people in society, maybe they feel the same ennui. They can't explain it, but they tend to their lawns, build topiaries in the backyard, and find any excuse to do something outside that molds that environment to their use. But for what? Is that creating an asset for them? Is it really as fulfilling as doing something else, something more unique? Is it a battle they can never complete? Now, I'm not holier than thou, friends. I actually really got into gardening when I was in Washington State, just outside Seattle, Redmond, Washington specifically. And I got into growing all sorts of things, herbs, tomatoes. I got all sorts of heirloom tomatoes off of Amazon, or the seeds rather, that you couldn't get in the grocery store. After all, if you're going to grow something, why not get something that either saves you a lot of money or is beautiful or that you can't get anywhere else? And the results were amazing. I mean, if you're going to grow anything, grow something in the Pacific Northwest, the weather and the volcanic soil, I am told, are credited with those supposed green thumbs that all of us who have lived there like to think we have. Now, before this part of our story concludes, I must express some frustration with everyone's obsession about tricking kids and adults alike with questions about whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable. I mean, come on. Why the tomato? Like, there are so many vegetables that do have seeds. The distinction based on seeds alone borders on inane. Botanists call anything with seeds a fruit. A lot of educated people know that. However, when you tell people to eat their veggies, or when you talk about making a vegetable on the side for dinner, obviously we all know what we're talking about, and so we need some other distinction. It's funny that when the question of whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable comes up, for some reason there's this, not cognitive dissonance, but just hyper-focus on the question and the example. If someone asked, does a vegetable or fruit have seeds or not? your expansion of evaluation of the question, what to answer, would be much more expansive. But when, at least me, a long time ago, of course, when posed with that question, and even witnessing other adults in this situation, or even kids, they fail to come up with all the other myriad vegetables that do have seeds. How about bell peppers? How about okra, squash, pumpkins, chili peppers, cucumbers? Look, you have a non-zero chance of becoming the next YouTube star, or perhaps for the ladies out there, or even a few of you guys, the next Instagram model, the next Visco girl or Visco guy. Is there such a thing? Look, your lawn and the traffic light down the street that you so want to write a strongly worded to the county about, they have nothing to do with your ambitions to start the Chipotle of Indian food, because those things are hobbit problems.
They stole it from us. Sneaky little hobbitses. Wicked, tricksy, fierce.
I've got my own issues with hobbit problems. I was looking at a National Geographic article, and I went into a National Geographic rabbit hole about how T-Rex supposedly had a bite that could crush a car. And this was based upon an analysis of its jawbones. Obviously, there are no muscles there, but presumably paleontologists looked at a number of skull samples and figured out what the force must have been, extrapolating from probably what crocodiles and lions and humans and sharks can do. That's not so bad. I don't mind that modeling and speculation. I suppose that's science. But then the article goes on to say that we don't know how, and that scientists are now hypothesizing that the T-Rex must have had some articulation sideways or something like that, or that the jaw could separate, something like that. I can't remember at the moment, but some of you are already ahead of the punchline here, which is the logic is totally circular. So let me back this up and summarize this again. Scientists analyzed bones to figure out how strong T-Rex's bite was. Now, because we know, supposedly know, those are quotation marks, air quotes here, we know how strong the bite was, we now need to figure out how the bite was so strong. There's three National Geographic articles about this. This is ridiculous. And this is why I feel paleontology is sort of like the kid brother of sciences. There's so many speculations in paleontology that I did call them speculations, so I don't even need to fill in the rest of the sentence. I already answered that. Maybe it's because no one knows what's going on in paleontology, so the first person to come up with some explanation just becomes the de facto leader and all the other paleontologists follow. I've never seen such wild speculation without any sort of challenge or with such minimal caveats as paleontology. You don't see this in physics, say. Someone comes up with something crazy, there will be plenty of challenges by journalists and other scientists. But you somehow paleontology gets away with this. But I suppose when all the sciences get together for pub crawls or dinner parties, that paleontology just wants to hang out with the cool kids, and I'm skeptical whether that actually happens. Maybe paleontology is the kid brother. That being said, paleontology is so pompous that I think Ross Geller portrayed them pretty well. Paleontologists are too busy chasing Jennifer Aniston to worry about scientific rigor. I have an on-again, off-again relationship with botany. Botany and I have broken up so many times. She's pissed at me right now for cheating with zoology. I thought we were on a break. No, I actually do like plants, although I don't know why we insist on making kids learn about plants. I think they should just go on nature walks. The only thing worse than making kids learn about plants is making them learn about earth science. don't get me wrong, earth science is pretty important to everything we do here on, well, Earth, but I think they should just call science for kids cool shit class. And every day they have someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson or Mr. Wizard or Bill Nye the Science Guy take them outside or explain some history lesson about some scientist almost blowing himself up or do some sort of scientific magic trick. That'll get kids into science. There's this compliment. He does the little things. You hear it in office environments. You might say it about someone yourself at a restaurant. Maybe a waiter did something. He does the little things. Women might say that about a guy they're dating. This compliment is not all bad, but focusing on the little things is not always the way to go. I can't tell you how many technology companies I've been in where people are debating what Slack channels to add and what to name them and who should be a part of them. Hobbit problems.
We don't need you. What?
There's a story dating back to ancient Greece that compares the hedgehog and the fox. And I'm, of course, paraphrasing because through millennia of translations, who's not paraphrasing anyway? The fox knows many things. The hedgehog knows one big thing. And this has been adapted and used by several people throughout history in their writings and aphorisms and other podcasts, the podcastosphere, as I call it. But maybe it should be that the hedgehog acts on one thing. The fox scampers around, acting on perhaps too many things. Hobbit problems.
Master's my friend. You don't have any friends. Nobody likes you. Not listening.
I was once at a startup that had a whole style guide for communications. And this wasn't just external communications. This was internal communications. Communications between even just two people at said company. Google Docs needed to be in title case. Emails needed to be in sentence case. Email subject lines needed to be in sentence case. Sometimes camel case was even called for. I can't remember what the difference between camel case and title case is right now, because it doesn't fucking matter.
Leave now and never come back.
There's a lot to be said about hyper-focus. And I think most people who are thoughtful about their career and individual self-improvement and self-improvement probably know this, but how few of us actually live that? And a company that focuses on too many little things fails to deliver on the one big thing. Those managers can continually refine all of the minor things, like hobbits, little lawnmower men, diligently sculpting the hedge groves of my typography. I almost sent a note on the help request form to my gym saying that they need more racks for the free weights because the free weights are just lying around, plates all over the place. And even when people clean them up, which at my gym is pretty good, they still don't actually have a place and someone's going to get hurt and they're just not really organized. But you know what? Hobbit problem. The bathroom hardware at a place where I make most of my income, the bathroom hardware is comically non-performant. The sinks make you put your hands in a place to turn on where they can't actually get wet. The soap gives little bird portions of soap. The toilets don't flush very well. And even though they have a manual button to press, you have to press the button ridiculously hard and hold it. And this is on every floor, every single bathroom in a, let's call it a medium-sized skyscraper that only one company owns. And I thought about putting in some sort of ticket or creating a wiki page dedicated to this cause. But what am I going to do? Amass an army of gnomes to totally replace all the plumbing fixtures in this place? It's probably a multi-million dollar project. Hobbit problem. At least it's a hobbit problem from my vantage point. Well, someone should get on that. So next time you have this urge to address some of these stupidly minor issues that are tangential to your goals and your well-being, just stop to realize for a second that that voice inside you that is making you want to do this is really yearning for building and achieving something else, and that this kind of Schmeagle or Gollum inside you sees as precious all these minor little things that really aren't.
And the way he goes, precious, gone, 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 Schmeagle is free.
There's a song called Little Things by Bush on perhaps their Razorblade Suitcase album. Might have been the one after that. I used to love that song. One of the lyrics goes, it's the little things that kill. And I thought it would actually be really appropriate for this podcast until I looked at the lyrics and especially the less debatable conclusions by the song meaning subculture of the internet, where apparently that song is about methamphetamine addiction.
Yes, precious. False. They will cheat you, hurt you, lie.
There's a Radiohead song called Little by Little. It's in my Get Stuff Done playlist on Spotify. The lyrics go something like this. Obligation, complication, routines and schedules, drug and kill you. Kill you. In case you didn't get that the first time, kill you. Little by little, by hook or by crook, never get nervous, never get judged. Additionally, I especially like the lyric that they use throughout the song, which goes, I'm such a tease, you're such a flirt. There's a lot of debate as to the meaning of this song. Some people contend that the most lovable thing about Radiohead songs is that oftentimes the lyrics are left abstract enough where you can apply your own interpretation. I don't know if I always love that explanation of what good art is, but here you could fairly apply the interpretation of this episode to the song in terms of letting the little things be. Let the hobbits back in the Shire live their pedestrian existence. There was a guy I went through SEAL training with, and he was a rather diminutive person, albeit a tough dude with a great personality. He had hairy feet. His nickname, obviously, was Bilbo Baggins. And that's the instructors who gave him that nickname, I'm pretty sure, not his fellow classmates. Unfortunately, the man who also, unfortunately, will only be known for the purposes of this podcast as Bilbo Baggins, died in a training accident. Rest in peace, brother. And now is the hour where we get all the way wet. I absolutely love the comments next to that Entertainment Weekly article that I quoted earlier. The article is from 1994 and it still exists on the internet. The comments are things like, oh, ghost of articles past, I call you forth. You can read the rest of them by clicking on the link in the show notes. I like to picture an SNL parody of the actors on set having no idea whether this thing was really going to succeed or not, and just wondering to themselves with their hairy feet and pointy ears and hobbit problems, whether the world would just make fun of them forever for being in this movie. I can picture Will Ferrell being in there with his bushy hair and some middle earthen clothing. And I love picturing Chris Kattan in this sketch. And if you don't know who Chris Kattan is, just to give you a flavor of how hilarious this guy is, he revealed later in his career that apparently he had really bad neck problems stemming from an injury that he sustained while jumping backwards off a chair or table during a Golden Girls parody. Last note on The Hobbits and Lord of the Rings. I feel like dorkiness is a uniquely male trait. And I wonder if by definition, dorkiness is just doing things that females find uninteresting or unattractive. I also wonder, are there any animals that exhibit dorkiness? Footnote numero tres. Is a seedless fruit a vegetable? Au contraire, mon frère. Seedless grapes aren't actually seedless. Neither are seedless watermelons or any other seedless produce that you find in the grocery store. It just so happens that there are several ways of producing seedless fruit. One of them has to do with sperm. The technical term is stenospermocarpy. You can also do it through other ways, like parthenocarpy. Regardless, the seeds are either stunted in their growth or aborted before they can reach maturity. Never thought that you could abort a seed in a plant, but apparently there are ways of doing this. And finally, on the fruit front, if your mind wasn't blown enough, almonds, wait for it, are not nuts. There's a great Quora post called, "Are almonds nuts? If not, what are they?" And apparently, almonds technically are drupes. Hazelnuts, acorns, chestnuts, true nuts. But almonds have a fleshy covering. If you've never seen an almond on a tree, it actually has a thin, fleshy covering that is unappetizing. And so it gets peeled off during the production process, or if you were to pick it off yourself. Whereas true nuts don't have that fleshy covering. Hence, almonds are not nuts. They're brainy, little, hard fruits. The best Quora post talks about we lay people and what we call nuts versus what scientists call nuts. And similar to the fruit versus vegetable debate earlier in this episode, I think the scientists are the overlords and we're the minions. Are we all just speaking minionese? And if you'd like to know what kind of fruit bananas are, then you should check out the show notes.
Banana.
While we're on the topic of epics and hero arcs like Lord of the Rings, Joseph Campbell has a classic book called Hero of a Thousand Faces, where he talks about templates of hero arcs. And it made me think about the Star Wars series, and in particular, how ridiculous some of those character names are. I like Star Wars. I grew up with Star Wars. But some things are just a little ridiculous, right? At least in Lord of the Rings, they have names that are kind of completely original. Whereas like Harry Potter and Star Wars, they just have names that are taking English words that you know the meaning to and just adding something to the beginning or the end, or chopping off a few letters so that it is plausibly something different. So for instance, like Darth Sidious Does anyone not know who's grown up and speaks the English language where his name comes from? It's kind of ridiculous. It's like IKEA. You walk around IKEA and you think that they're just making up names for table brands and that new sconce that you think you really need. I like brainstorming other alternative names before they arrived at Darth Sidious, like Darth Pessimism or Darth Anxiety Disorder, or how about Darth Passive Aggressive? I kind of like, Insidious is like, to be insidious is not like terribly evil. It's just like kind of, it has harmful effects, right? So there's all sorts of things that are insidious and aren't, you know, taking over the entire galaxy. So, you know, something on that level is like being tardy, right? Like, could there just be a Darth Tardy? I like to picture Samuel L. Jackson just like making a nickname out of it. Darth Tardy, like, hey, Darty. There's a version of Little by Little that you can find on YouTube. It is so good. It's from the Basement series, which was created by music producer Nigel Godrich. And a lot of different artists have been on there, like Radiohead and the White Stripes, several others. And in this version, the beat is sick. The guitars are filthy. Radiohead actually did 2 full albums on From the Basement. Nobody else has done that. I especially like a few tracks from the In Rainbows album on From the Basement, which you can also find on YouTube. Those tracks are Weird Fishes / Arpeggi, 15 Step, and Body Snatchers. Which, speaking of Body Snatchers, if you didn't listen to the last episode on Decision Zombies, you definitely should. When those complications try to kill you, rise above. Hobbit problems. The Warrior Poet is a property of Rainiac Productions. The helicopter fills you heard come courtesy of Mike Koenig. Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shree.
No, 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 Kevin. Mina dua. Spita.